10. Next day, both Norm Schein and Todd Morris spent the early hours with him, teaching him the knack of operating the bulldozers and dredges and scoops which had fallen into various stages of ruin. Most of the equipment, like old Tomcats, could be coaxed into one more effort. But the results did not amount to much. They had been discarded for too long. By noon he was exhausted, so he treated himself to a break, resting in the shade of a mammoth, rusty tractor, eating a cold rations lunch and drinking tepid tea from a thermos which Fran Schein had been kind enough to bring up to him. Below in the hovel, the others did whatever it was they customarily did. He didn't care. On all sides of him, their abandoned, decaying gardens could be seen, and he wondered if soon he would forget his, too. Maybe each new colonist had started out this way, in an agony of effort, and then the torpor, the hopelessness, claimed them. And yet, was it so hopeless? Not really. It's an attitude, he decided, and we, all of us who comprised PP layouts, contributed willingly to it. We gave them an out, something painless and easy. And now Palmer Eldridge has arrived to put the finish on the process. We laid the path for him, myself included, and so what now? Is there any way that I can, as Fane put it, atone? Approaching him, Helen Morris called cheerfully, "How's the farming coming?" She dropped down beside him and opened a fat seed catalog with the UN stamp plainly marked throughout. "Observe what they'll provide free. Every seed known to thrive here, including turnips." Resting against him, she turned the pages. "However, there's a little mouse-like burrowing mammal that shows up on the surface late at night. Be prepared for that. It eats everything. You'll have to set out a few self-propelling traps." "Okay," Barney said. "It's quite some sight, one of those homeostatic traps taking off across the sand in pursuit of a marsupial mouse." "God, they go fast, both the mouse and the trap. You can make it more interesting by placing a bet. I usually bet on the trap. I admire them."
"I think I'd probably bet on the trap, too." "I've got a great respect for traps," he reflected. "In other words, a situation in which none of the doors lead out, no matter how they happen to be marked."
Helen said, "Also, the UN will supply 2 robots free of charge for your use, for a period not to exceed 6 months, so better plan ahead wisely as to how you want to employ them. The best is to set them to work constructing irrigation ditches. Ours is mostly no good now. Sometimes the ditches have to run 200 miles, even more. Or you can hatch out a deal."
"No deals," Barney said.
"But these are good deals. Find someone nearby in one of the other hovels who started his own irrigation system and then abandoned it. Buy it from him and tap it. Is your girl at Flaxback Spit going to come over here and join you?"
She eyed him.
He did not answer. He watched, in the black Martian sky with its noontime stars, a circling ship. The Choosy Man? The time then had come for him to poison himself so that an economic monopoly could be kept alive, a sprawling interplan empire from which he now derived nothing. Amazing, he thought, how strong the self-destructive drive can be. Helen Morris, straining to see, said,
"Visitors, it's not a UN ship either."
She started toward the hovel at once. "I'll go tell them." With his left hand, he reached into his coat and touched the tube deep in the interior pocket, thinking to himself, "Can I actually do this?" It didn't seem possible. There was nothing in his makeup historically which would explain it. Maybe, he thought, it's from despair at having lost everything. But he didn't think so. It was something else. As the ship landed on the flat desert not far off, he thought, maybe it's to reveal something to Anne about Chu Zi, even if the demonstration is faked. Because he thought, if I accept the toxin into my system, she won't try Chu Zi. He had a strong intuition of that. And it was enough. From the ship stepped Palmer Eldridge. No one could fail to identify him since his crash on Pluto, the homeopapes had printed one pic after another. Of course, the pics were 10 years out of date, but this was still the man. Gray and bony, well over 6 feet tall, with swinging arms and a peculiarly rapid gait. And his face, it had a ravaged quality, eaten away, as if, Barney conjectured, the fat layer had been consumed, as if Eldritch at some time or other had fed off himself, devoured perhaps with gusto these superfluous portions of his own body. He had enormous steel teeth, these having been installed prior to his trip to Prox by Czech dental surgeons. They were welded to his jaws, were permanent. He would die with them. And his right arm was artificial. 20 years ago, in a hunting accident on Callisto, he had lost the original. This one, of course, was superior in that it provided a specialized variety of interchangeable hands. At the moment, Eldritch made use of the five-finger humanoid manual extremity. Except for its metallic shine, it might have been organic. And he was blind, at least from the standpoint of the natural-born body. But replacements had been made, at the prices which Eldritch could and would pay, that had been done just prior to his Prox voyage by Brazilian oculists. They had done a superb job. The replacements, fitted into the bone sockets, had no pupils, nor did any ball move by muscular action. Instead, a panoramic vision was supplied by a wide-angle lens, a permanent horizontal slot running from edge to edge. The accident to his original eyes had been no accident. It had occurred in Chicago, a deliberate acid-throwing attack by persons unknown for equally unknown reasons, at least as far as the public was concerned. Eldritch probably knew. He had, however, said nothing, filed no complaint. Instead, he had gone straight to his team of Brazilian oculists. His horizontally slotted artificial eyes seemed to please him. Almost at once, he had appeared at the dedication ceremonies of the new St. George Opera House in Utah and had mixed with his near peers without embarrassment. Even now, a decade later, the operation was rare, and it was the first time Barney had ever seen the Jensen wide-angle Luxvid eyes. This and the artificial arm, with its enormously variable manual repertory, impressed him more than he would have expected. Or was there something else about Eldritch? "Mr. Meyerson," Palmer Eldritch said and smiled. The steel teeth glinted in the weak, cold Martian sunlight. He extended his hand, and automatically Barney did the same. "Your voice," Barney thought. "It originates somewhere other than..." He blinked. The entire figure was insubstantial. Dimly through it, the landscape showed. It was a figment of some sort, artificially produced. And the irony came to him. So much of the man was artificial already, and now even the flesh and blood portions were, too. Is this what arrived home from Prox? Barney wondered. If so, Hepburn Gilbert has been deceived. This is no human being, in no sense whatsoever. "I'm still in the ship," Palmer Eldritch said. His voice boomed from a loudspeaker mounted on the ship's hull. "A precaution, inasmuch as you're an employee of Leo Bolero." The figment hand touched Barney's. He experienced a pervasive coldness slop over to him. Obviously a purely psychological aversion reaction, since nothing was there to produce the sensation. "An ex-employee," Barney said. Behind him now, the others of the hovel emerged, the Shines and Morrises and Regans. They approached like wary children as one by one they identified the nebulous man confronting Barney. "What's going on?" Norm Shine said uneasily. "This is a simulacrum. I don't like it." Standing beside Barney, he said, "We're living on the desert, Meyerson. We get mirages all the time. Ships and visitors and unnatural life forms. That's what this is. This guy isn't really here, and neither is that ship part there." Todd Morris added, "They're probably 600 miles away.
It's an optical phenomenon. You get used to it. But you can hear me, Palmer Eldritch pointed out. The speaker boomed and echoed. I'm here, all right, to do business with you. Who's your Hovel team, Captain? I am, Norm Shine said. My card. Eldritch held out a small white card, and reflexively Norm Shine reached for it. The card fluttered through his fingers and came to rest on the sand. At that, Eldritch smiled. It was a cold, hollow smile, an implosion, as if it had drawn back into the man everything nearby, even the thin air itself. Look down at it, Eldritch suggested. Norm Shine bent and studied the card. That's right, Eldritch said. I'm here to sign a contract with your group, to deliver to you. Spare us the speech about your delivering what God only promises, Norm Shine said. Just tell us the price. About 1/10 that of the competitor's product, and much more effective. You don't even require a layout. Eldritch seemed to be talking directly to Barney. His gaze, however, could not be plotted because of the structure of the lens apertures. Are you enjoying it here on Mars, Mr. Meyerson? It's great fun, Barney said. Eldritch said, last night, when Alan Fane descended from his dull little satellite to meet with you, what did you discuss? Rigidly, Barney said, business. He thought quickly, but not quite quickly enough. The next question was already blaring from the speaker. So, you do still work for Leo? In fact, it was deliberately arranged to send you here to Mars in advance of our first distribution of Choose E. Why? Have you some idea of blocking it? There was no propaganda in your luggage, no leaflets or other printed matter beyond ordinary books. A rumor, perhaps. Word of mouth. Choose E is, what, Mr. Meyerson? Dangerous to the habitual user? I don't know. I'm waiting to try some of it and see. We're all waiting, Fran Shine said. She carried in her arms a load of truffle skins, clearly for immediate payment. Can you make a delivery right now, or do we have to keep on waiting? I can deliver your first allocation, Eldritch said. A port of the ship snapped open. From it popped a small jet tractor. It sped toward them. A yard away, it halted and ejected a carton wrapped in familiar plain brown paper. The carton lay at their feet, and then, at last, Norm Shine bent and picked it up. It was not a phantasm. Cautiously, Norm tore the wrappings off. Choosy, Mary Regan said breathlessly. Oh, what a lot! How much, Mr. Eldritch? In toto, Eldritch said. 5 skins. The tractor extended a small drawer, then, precisely the size to receive the skins. After an interval of haggling, the Hovelists came to an arrangement. The 5 skins were deposited in the drawer. At once, it was withdrawn, and the tractor swiveled and zipped back to the mothership. Farmer Eldritch, insubstantial and gray and large, remained. He appeared to be enjoying himself, Barney decided. It did not bother him to know that Leo Bolero had something up his sleeve. Eldritch thrived on this. The realization depressed him, and he walked alone to the meager cleared place which was eventually to be his garden. His back to the Hovelists and Eldritch, he activated an autonomic unit. It began to wheeze and hum. Sand disappeared into it as it sucked noisily, having difficulty. He wondered how long it would continue functioning, and what one did here on Mars to obtain repairs. Perhaps one gave up. Maybe there were no repairs. From behind Barney, Palmer Eldritch's voice came. Now, Mr. Meyerson, you can begin to chew away for the rest of your life. He turned involuntarily, because this was not a phantasm. The man had finally come forth. That's right, he said, and nothing could delight me more. He continued then, tinkering with the autonomic scoop. "Where do you go to get equipment fixed on Mars?" he asked Eldritch. "Does the UN take care of that?" Eldritch said, "How would I know?" A portion of the autonomic scoop broke loose in Barney's hands. He held it, waited. The piece, shaped like a tire iron, was heavy, and he thought, "I could kill him with this. Right here, in this spot. Wouldn't that solve it? No toxin to produce grand mal seizures, no litigation. But there'd be retaliation from them. I'd outlive Eldritch by only a few hours. But isn't it still worth it?" He turned. And then it happened so swiftly that he had no valid concept of it, not even an accurate perception. From the parked ship, a laser beam reached forth, and he felt the intense impact as it touched the metal section in his hands. At the same time, Palmer Eldritch danced back, lightly, bounding upward in the slight Martian gravity. Like a balloon, Barney stared but did not believe. He floated off, grinning with his huge steel teeth, waggling his artificial arm, his lank body slowly rotating. Then, as if reeled in by a transparent line, he progressed in a jerky sine wave motion toward the ship. All at once he was gone. The nose of the ship clamped shut after him. Eldritch was inside, safe. "Why'd he do that?" Norm Schein said, eaten with curiosity, where he and the other hovelists stood. "What in God's name went on there?" Barney said nothing. Shakily, he set the remains of the metal piece down. They were ash-like remnants only, brittle and dry. They crumbled away as they touched the ground. "They got into a hassle," Todd Morris said, Meyerson and Eldritch. "They didn't hit it off, not one bit." "Anyhow," Norm said, "we got the 2Z. Meyerson, you better stay away from Eldritch in the future. Let me handle the transaction. If I had known that because you were an employee of Leo Bolero..." "Former," Barney said reflexively, and resumed his tinkering with the defective autonomic scoop. He had failed in his first try at killing Palmer Eldritch. Would he ever have a chance again? Had he really had a chance just now? The answer to both, he decided, was no. Late that afternoon, the hovelists of Chicken Pox Prospect gathered to chew. The mood was one of tension and solemnity. Scarcely anything was said as the bindles of Chew-Z, one by one, were unwrapped and passed around. "Ugh," Fran Schein said, making a face. "It tastes awful." "Taste schmaced," Norm said impatiently. He chewed then. "Like a decayed mushroom. You sure are right." Stoically, he swallowed and continued chewing. "Gah!" he said, and retched. "To be doing this without a layout," Helen Morris said. "Where will we go? Just anywhere? I'm scared," she said all at once. "Will we be together? Are you positive of that, Norm?" "Who cares?" Sam Regan said, chewing. "Watch me," Barney Meyerson said. They glanced at him with curiosity. Something in his tone made them do as he said. "I put the Chew-Z in my mouth," Barney said, "and did so. You see me doing it, right?" He chewed. "Now I'm chewing it." His heart labored. God, he thought, can I go through with this? "Yeah, we see you," Todd Morris agreed, nodding. "So what? I mean, are you going to blow up or float off like Eldritch or something?" He, too, began on his bindle then. They were all chewing, all seven of them, Barney realized. He shut his eyes. The next thing he knew, his wife was bending over him. "I said," she said, "do you want a second Manhattan or not? Because if you do, I have to request the refrige for more cracked ice." "Emily," he said. "Yes, dear," she said tartly. "Whenever you say my name like that, I know you're about to launch in on one of your lectures. What is it this time?" She seated herself on the arm of the couch opposite him, smoothing her skirt. It was the striking blue and white hand-printed Mexican wraparound that he had gotten her at Christmas. "I'm ready," she said. "No lecture," he said. Am I really that way? He asked himself. Always delivering tirades? Groggily, he rose to his feet. He felt dizzy, and he steadied himself by holding on to the nearby pole lamp. Eyeing him, Emily said, "You're blammed." Blammed? He hadn't heard that term since college. It was long out of style, and naturally Emily still used it. "The word," he said as distinctly as possible, "is now snoogled. Can you remember that? Snoogled." He walked unsteadily to the sideboard in the kitchen where the liquor was. "Snoogled," Emily said and sighed. She looked sad. He noticed that and wondered why. "Barney," she said then, "don't drink so much, okay? Call it blamed or snoogled or anything you want, it's still the same. I guess it's my fault. You drink so much because I'm so inadequate." She wiped briefly with her knuckle at her right eye, an annoying, familiar, tick-like motion. "It's not that you're so inadequate," he said. "It's just that I have high standards." "I was taught to expect a lot from others," he said to himself. "To expect they'd be as reputable and stable as I am, and not sloppily emotional all the time, not in control of themselves." But an artist, he realized. Or rather, so-called artist. Bohemian, that's closer to it. The artistic life without the talent. He began fixing himself a fresh drink, this one bourbon and water without ice. He poured directly from the bottle of Old Crow, ignoring the shot glass. "When you pour that way," Emily said, "I know you're angry and we're in for it, and I just hate it." "So then leave," he said. "God damn you," Emily said. "I don't want to leave. Couldn't you just..." She gestured with hopeless futility. "Be a little nicer, more charitable or something. Learn to overlook..." Her voice sank almost inaudibly, she said. "My shortcomings." "But," he said, "they can't be overlooked. I'd like to. You think I want to live with someone who can't finish anything they start or accomplish anything socially? For instance, when..." Ah, the hell with it. What was the use? Emily couldn't be reformed. She was purely and simply a slob. Her idea of a well-spent day was to wallow and putter and fool with a mess of greasy, excretion-like paints, or bury her arms for hours on end in a great crock of wet gray clay. And meanwhile, time was escaping from them. And all the world, including all of Mr. Bolero's employees, especially his pre-fash consultants, grew and augmented themselves, bloomed into maturity. "I'll never be the New York pre-fash consultant," he said to himself. "I'll always be stuck here in Detroit where nothing, absolutely nothing new, originates." If he could snare the position of New York pre-fash consultant, my life would mean something, he realized. I'd be happy, because I'd be doing a job that made full use of my ability. What the hell else would I need? Nothing else. That's all I ask. "I'm going out," he said to Emily and set down his glass. Going to the closet, he got his coat. "Will you be back before I go to bed?" Mournfully, she followed him to the door of the Connaught. Here in building 1113958-4, counting outward from downtown New York, where they had lived 2 years now. "We'll see," he said, and opened the door. In the hallway stood a figure, a tall gray man with bulging steel teeth, dead pupilless eyes, and a gleaming artificial hand extended from his right sleeve. The man said, "Hello, Meyerson." He smiled. The steel teeth shone. "Palmer Eldritch," Barney said. He turned to Emily. "You've seen his pics in the homeopaths. He's that incredibly famous big industrialist." Naturally, he had recognized Eldritch, and at once... "Did you want to see me?" he asked hesitantly. It all had a mysterious quality to it, as if it had all somehow happened before, but in another way. "Let me talk to your husband a moment," Eldritch said to Emily in a peculiarly gentle voice. He motioned, and Barney stepped out into the hall. The door shut behind him. Emily had closed it obediently. Now Eldritch seemed grim, no longer gentle or smiling, he said.
Meyerson, you're using your time badly. You're doing nothing but repeating the past. What's the use of my selling you choosy? You're perverse. I've never seen anything like it. I'll give you 10 more minutes, and then I'm bringing you back to Chickenpox Prospects, where you belong. So you better figure out very damn fast what you want, and if you understand anything, finally.
What the hell, Barney said, is choosy? The artificial hand lifted. With enormous force, Palmer Eldritch shoved him, and he toppled.
Hey,
Barney said weakly, trying to fight back, to nullify the pressure of the man's immense strength.
What?
And then he was flat on his back. His head rang, ached. With difficulty, he managed to open his eyes and focus on the room around him. He was waking up. He had on, he discovered, his pajamas. But they were unfamiliar. He had never seen them before. Was he in someone else's conapt, wearing their clothes? Some other man? In panic, he examined the bed, the covers. Beside him, he saw an unfamiliar girl who slept on, breathing lightly through her mouth, her hair a tumble of cotton-like white, shoulders bare and smooth.
I'm late, he said, and his voice came out distorted and husky, almost unrecognizable.
No, you're not, the girl murmured, eyes still shut. Relax. We can get into work from here in... She yawned and opened her eyes. 15 minutes. She smiled at him. His discomfort amused her.
You always say that, every morning. Go see about coffee. I've got to have coffee.
Sure, he said, and scrambled out of bed.
Mr. Rabbit, the girl said mockingly, you're so scared. Scared about me, about your job, and always running.
My God, he said. I've turned my back on everything.
What everything?
Emily. He stared at the girl, Ronnie something or other, at her bedroom. Now I've got nothing, he said.
Oh, fine, Ronnie said with embittered sarcasm. Now maybe I can say some nice things to you to make you feel good.
He said, and I did it just now, not years ago. Just before Palmer Eldritch came in.
How could Palmer Eldritch come in? He's in a hospital bed out in the Jupiter or Saturn area. The UN took him there after they pried him from the wreck of his ship.
Her tone was scornful, and yet there was a note of curiosity in it. Palmer Eldritch appeared to me just now, he said doggedly. He thought, I have to get back to Emily. Sliding, stooping, he grabbed up his clothes, stumbled with them to the bathroom and slammed the door behind him. Rapidly he shaved, changed, emerged, and said to the girl who still lay in bed, I have to go. Don't be sore at me. I have to do it. A moment later, without having had breakfast, he was descending to the ground-level floor, and after that he stood under the anti-thermal shield, searching up and down for a cab. The cab, a fine, shiny new model, whipped him in almost no time to Emily's Connaught's building. In a blur, he paid it, hurried inside, and in a matter of seconds was ascending. It seemed as if no time had passed, as if time had ceased and everything waited, frozen for him. He was in a world of fixed objects, the sole moving thing. At her door, he rang the buzzer. The door opened, and a man stood there.
Yes?
The man was dark, reasonably good-looking, with heavy eyebrows and carefully combed, somewhat curly hair. He held the morning paper in one hand. Behind him, Barney saw a table of breakfast dishes. Barney said, You're Richard Knapp.
Yes.
Puzzled, he regarded Barney intently. Do I know you? Emily appeared wearing a gray turtleneck sweater and stained jeans.
Good heavens, it's Barney, she said to Nat. My former, come in.
She held the door wide open for him, and he entered the apt. She seemed pleased to see him.
Glad to meet you,
Nat said in a neutral tone, starting to extend his hand and then changing his mind.
Coffee?
Thanks. Barney seated himself at the breakfast table at an unset place. "Listen," he said to Emily. He couldn't wait. It had to be said now, even with Nat present. "I made a mistake in divorcing you. I'd like to remarry you. Go back on the old basis." Emily, in a way which he remembered, laughed with delight. She was overcome, and she went off to get him a cup and saucer, unable to answer. He wondered if she would ever answer. It was easier for her. It appealed to the lazy slob in her just to laugh. Christ, he thought, and stared straight ahead fixedly. Across from him, Nat seated himself and said, "We're married. Did you suppose we were just living together?" His face was dark, but he seemed in control of himself. Barney said, speaking to Emily and not to Nat, "Marriages can be broken. Will you remarry me?" He rose and took a few hesitant steps in her direction. At that moment she turned and calmly handed him his cup and saucer. "Oh, no," she said, still smiling. Her eyes poured over with light, that of compassion. She understood how he felt, that this was not an impulse only. But the answer was still no, and he knew it would always be. Her mind was not even made up. There was to her simply no reality to which he was referring. He thought, "I cut her down once, cut her off, lopped her, with thorough knowledge of what I was doing, and this is the result. I am seeing the bread, as they say, which was cast on the water, drifting back to choke me. Water-soaked bread that will lodge in my throat, never to be swallowed or disgorged, either one. It's precisely what I deserve," he said to himself. "I made the situation." Returning to the kitchen table, he numbly seated himself, sat as she filled his cup. He stared at her hands. "Once, these were my wife's," he said to himself, "and I gave it up. Self-destruction. I wanted to see myself die. That's the only possible satisfactory explanation. Or was I that stupid? No, stupidity wouldn't encompass such an enormity, so complete, a willful..." Emily said, "How are things, Barney?" "Oh, hell. Just plain great." His voice shook. "I hear you're living with a very pretty little redhead," Emily said. She seated herself at her own place and resumed her meal. "That's over," Barney said, "forgotten." "Who, then?" Her tone was conversational. "Passing the time of day with me as if I were an old pal or perhaps a neighbor from another apt in this building," he thought. "Madness! How can she feel like this? Impossible! It's an act, burying something deeper." Aloud, he said, "You're afraid that if you get mixed up with me again, I'll toss you out again. Once burned, twice warned. But I won't. I'll never do anything like that again." In her placid conversational voice, Emily said, "I'm sorry you feel so bad, Barney. Aren't you seeing an analyst? Somebody said they saw you carrying a psychiatric suitcase around with you." "Dr. Smile," he said, remembering. Probably he had left him at Ronnie Fugate's apt. "I need help," he said to Emily. "Isn't there any way..." He broke off. "Can't the past be altered?" he asked himself. Evidently not. Cause and effect work in only one direction, and change is real. So what's gone is gone, and I might as well get out of here. He rose to his feet. "I must be out of my mind," he said to both her and Richard Nat. "I'm sorry. I'm only half awake. This morning I'm disoriented. It started when I woke up." "Drink your coffee, why don't you?" Nat suggested. "How about some bear's claw to go with it?" The darkness had left his face. He, like Emily, was now tranquil, uninvolved. Barney said, "I don't understand it. Palmer Eldritch said to come here." Or had he? Something like that. He was certain of it. "This was supposed to work out, I thought," he said helplessly. Nat and Emily glanced at each other. "Eldritch is in a hospital somewhere," Emily began. "Something's gone wrong," Barney said. "Eldritch must have lost control. I better find him. He can explain it to me." and he felt panic. Mercury swift, fluid, pervasive panic. It filled him to his fingertips. "Goodbye," he managed to say, and started toward the door, groping for escape. From behind him, Richard Knapp said, "Wait." Barney turned. At the breakfast table, Emily sat with a fixed, faint smile on her face, sipping her coffee. And across from her, Nat sat facing Barney. Nat had one artificial hand with which he held his fork, and when he lifted a bite of egg to his mouth, Barney saw huge, jutting, stainless steel teeth. And Nat was gray, hollowed out with dead eyes, and much larger than before. He seemed to fill the room with his presence. But it was still Nat. "I don't get it," Barney said, and stood at the door, not leaving the apt and not returning. He did as Nat suggested. He waited. "Isn't this something like Palmer Eldritch?" he asked himself. "In Pix, he has an artificial limb and steel teeth and Jensen eyes. But this was not Eldritch." "It's only fair to tell you," Nat said matter-of-factly, "that Emily is a lot fonder of you than what she says suggests. I know because she's told me many times." He glanced at Emily then. "You're a duty type. You feel it's the moral thing to do at this point, to suppress your emotions toward Barney. It's what you've been doing all along anyhow. But forget your duty. You can't build a marriage on it. There has to be spontaneity there. Even if you feel it's wrong to..." He made a gesture. "Well, let's say, deny me. Still, you should face your feelings honestly and not cover them with a self-sacrificing facade. That's what you did with Barney here. You let him kick you out because you thought it was your duty not to interfere with his career." He added, "You're still behaving that way, and it's still a mistake. Be true to yourself." And all at once, he grinned at Barney, grinned, and one dead eye flicked off, as if in a mechanical wink. It was Palmer Eldritch now, completely. Emily, however, did not appear to notice. Her smile had faded, and she looked confused, upset, and increasingly furious. "You make me so damn angry," she said to her husband. "I said how I feel, and I'm not a hypocrite, and I don't like to be accused of being one." Across from her, the seated man said, "You have only one life. If you want to live it with Barney instead of me..." "I don't," she glared at him. "I'm going," Barney said. He opened the hall door. It was hopeless. "Wait." Palmer Eldritch rose and sauntered after him. "I'll walk downstairs with you." Together, the two of them trudged down the hall toward the steps. "Don't give up," Eldritch said. "Remember, this is only the initial time you've made use of Choosy. You'll have other times later. You can keep chipping away until eventually you get it." Barney said, "What the hell is Choosy?" From close behind him, a girl's voice was repeating, "Barney Meyerson, come on." He was being shaken. He blinked, squinted. Kneeling, her hand on his shoulder, was Anne Hawthorne. "What was it like? I stopped by and I couldn't find anyone around. Then I ran across all of you here in a circle, completely passed out. What if I had been a UN official?" "You woke me," he said to Anne, realizing what she had done. He felt massive, resentful disappointment. However, the translation for the time being was over, and that was that. But he experienced the craving within him, the yearning, to do it again, and as soon as possible. Everything else was unimportant, even the girl beside him, and his inert, very quiet fellow hovelist slumped here and there. "It was that good," Anne said perceptively. She touched her coat. "He visited our hovel, too." "I bought. The man with the strange teeth and eyes, that gray big man. Eldritch, or a simulacrum of him." His joints ached, as if he had been sitting doubled up for hours, and yet, examining his watch, he saw that only a few seconds, a minute at the most, had passed. "Eldritch is everywhere," he said to Anne. "Give me your choosie," he said to her.
"No."
He shrugged, concealing his disappointment, the acute physical impact of deprivation. Well, Palmer Eldritch would be returning. He surely knew the effects of his product, possibly even later today.
"Tell me about it," Anne said.
Barney said, "It's an illusory world in which Eldritch holds the key positions as God. He gives you a chance to do what you can't really ever do, reconstruct the past as it ought to have been. But even for him it's hard, takes time." He was silent then. He sat, rubbing his aching forehead.
"You mean he can't, and you can't just wave your arms and get what you want, as you can in a dream?"
"It's absolutely not like a dream." It was worse, he realized, more like being in hell, he thought.
"Yes, that's the way hell must be, recurrent and unyielding."
But Eldritch thought in time, with sufficient patience and effort, it could be changed.
"If you go back," Anne began.
"If." He stared at her. "I've got to go back. I wasn't able to accomplish anything this time." Hundreds of times, he thought, it might take that.
"Listen, for God's sake, give me that choosy Bindle you've got there. I know I can convince her. I've got Eldritch himself on my side, plugging away. Right now she's mad, and I took her by surprise."
He became silent. He stared at Anne Hawthorne.
"There's something wrong," he thought,
"because..." Anne had one artificial arm in hand. The plastic and metal fingers were only inches from him, and he could discern them clearly. And when he looked up into her face, he saw the hollowness, the emptiness as vast as the intersystem space out of which Eldritch had emerged. The dead eyes, filled with space beyond the known visited world.
"You can have more later," Anne said calmly. "One session a day is enough."
She smiled.
"Otherwise, you'd run out of skins. You wouldn't be able to afford any more. And then what the hell would you do?"
Her smile glinted, the shiny opulence of stainless steel. The other hovelists, on all sides of him, groaned into wakefulness, recovering by slow, anguished stages. They sat up, mumbled, and tried to orient themselves. Anne had gone somewhere. By himself, he managed to get to his feet. "Coffee," he thought. "I'll bet she's fixing coffee."
"Wow," Norm Shine said. "Where'd you go?" Todd Morris demanded, thick-tongued.
Blearily, he too stood, then assisted his wife Helen. "I was back in my teens in high school, when I was on my first complete date. First, you get me successful one. You follow?" He glanced nervously at Helen then. Mary Regan said, "It's much better than candy, infinitely. Oh, if I could tell you what I was doing." She giggled self-consciously. "I just can't, though." Her face shone hot and red. Going off to his own compartment, Barney Meyerson locked the door and got out the tube of toxin that Alan Fane had given him. He held it in his hand, thinking, "Now is the time."
"But are we back?
Did I see nothing more than a residual view of Eldritch superimposed on Anne? Or perhaps it had been genuine insight, perception of the actual, of their unqualified situation, not just his, but all of theirs together? If so, it was not the time to receive the toxin. Instinct offered him that point of observation. Nevertheless, he unscrewed the lid of the tube. A tiny, frail voice emanating from the open tube piped, "You're being watched, Meyerson. And if you're up to some kind of tactic, we'll be required to step in. You will be severely restricted. Sorry." He put the lid back on the tube and screwed it tight with shaking fingers. And the tube had been empty.
"What is it?"
Anne said, appearing. She had been in the kitchen of his compartment. She wore an apron, which she had discovered somewhere.
"What's that?" she asked, seeing the tube in his hand. "Escape," he grated, "from this."
From exactly what?
Her normal appearance had reasserted itself. Nothing now was amiss.
"You look positively sick, Barney. You really do. Is it an after effect of the choosy?"
"A hangover."
"Is Palmer Eldritch actually inside this?" he wondered, examining the closed tube. He revolved it in the palm of his hand.
"Is there any way to contact the famed satellite?"
"Oh, I imagine so. You probably just put in a vid call or whatever their means of..."
"Go ask Norm Schein to make the contact for me," he said. Obligingly, Anne departed. The compartment door shut after her. At once, he dug the code book which Fane had presented him from its hiding place beneath the kitchen stove. This would have to be encoded. The pages of the code book were blank. "Then it won't go in code," he said to himself, "and that's that. I'll have to do the best I can and let it go, however unsatisfactory." The door swung open. Anne appeared and said, "Mr. Schein is placing the call for you. They request particular tunes all the time, he says." He followed her down the corridor and into a cramped little room where Norm sat at a transmitter. As Barney entered, he turned his head and said, "I've got Charlotte. Will that do?"
"Alan," Barney said.
"Okay." Presently, Norm said, "Now I've got old eggplant, Al. Here." He handed the microphone to Barney. On the tiny screen, Alan Fane's face, jovial and professional, appeared. "A new citizen to talk to you," Norm explained, reclutching the microphone briefly. "Barney Myerson, meet half of the team that keeps us alive and sane here on Mars." To himself, he muttered, "God, have I got a headache. Excuse me." He vacated the chair at the transmitter and disappeared totteringly down the hall. "Mr. Fane," Barney said carefully, "I was speaking with Mr. Palmer Eldritch earlier today. He mentioned the conversation that you and I had." "He was aware of it, so far as I can see. There's no..." Coldly, Alan Fane said, "What conversation?" For an interval, Barney was silent. "Evidently they had an infrared camera going," he continued at last, "probably in a satellite that was making its pass. However, the contents of our conversation, it would appear, is still not..."
"You're a nut," Fane said. "I don't know you. I never had any conversation with you."
"Well, man, have you a request or not?"
His face was impassive, oblique with detachment, and it did not seem simulated.
"You don't know who I am?" Barney said unbelievingly. Fane cut the connection at his end, and the tiny vid screen fused over, now showing only emptiness, the void. Barney shut off the transmitter. He felt nothing, apathy. He walked past Anne and out into the corridor. There he halted, got out his package, was it the last, of Terran cigarettes, and lit up, thinking, what Eldritch did to Leo on Luna, or Sigma 14B, or wherever, he's done to me, too. And eventually he'll snare us all, just like this, isolated. The communal world is gone. At least for me. He began with me. And he thought, I'm supposed to fight back with an empty tube that once may or may not have contained a rare, expensive, brain-disorganizing toxin, but which now contains only Palmer Eldritch, and not even all of him, just his voice. The match burned his fingers. He ignored it.